All right, now we can proceed. We got up to 14, but I haven't talked about 14 at all yet. This is just a standard negative feedback mechanism working here. So you have, to start with, in the upper left, elevated blood pressure. That is an error, right? The pressure is higher than the set point pressure. Therefore, that's an error. Negative feedback should negate that error. Well, the way it operates, though, is that when the blood pressure is higher than it should be, that means that pressure is going to stretch the arteries, right, more than they would be normally stretched. And those baroreceptors are those stretch receptors that respond to that stretch. Where are those found? Mainly in the aorta, the ascending aorta. So the carotid bodies and the aortic bodies, those weren't baroreceptors. Those were chemoreceptors. All right? So the aorta stretches out, which makes sense to put the stretch receptor in the aorta. It's the first thing after the heart. And that's what tells the brain, basically, that the blood pressure is too high. Notice the fork in the road, though. Two things are activated here, or two responses occur. Cardioinhibitory neurons are stimulated. Well, cardioinhibitory neurons, as the name indicates, means that when those neurons fire, that's going to have the ultimate effect of slowing the heart down. I should say reducing cardiac output. Now, cardiac output, by the way, I don't think I defined that back in the heart chapter, did I? Cardiac output is the product of, or it equals two things multiplied together. Heart rate, HR, and stroke volume, SV. Now, heart rate has what as units? Beats per minute. What about stroke volume? What does stroke volume refer to? The stroke volume is the volume of blood that's expelled from the ventricle in one beat. So that means that would have milliliters per beat. And when you multiply these two together, the beat cancels out. So cardiac output is in units of milliliters per minute, which makes sense, right? A given volume in a certain amount of time. Well, there's a couple ways that you can adjust cardiac output at the heart. Of course, you have to do it at the heart. It's the cardiac output. You can make the heart change in its frequency of beating. In other words, you can change the heartbeat, the heart rate. But you can also change how vigorously the heart is contracting, how strenuously it's contracting. In other words, you can adjust stroke volume as well. And the cardioinhibitory neurons are going to tell the heart, I mean, they're going to have the ultimate effect of telling the heart to reduce the heart rate, in this case, notice there. But the neurons that get stimulated have the direct effect of increasing vagal tone. What is vagal tone? Vagal is the adjective of vagus, V-A-G-U-S. And what's vagus? It means wanderer, but what is it? It's a nerve, right? What kind of nerve? One of the cranial nerves, right? Cranial nerve number 10. The cranial nerve, I mean, the tone of a nerve means the amount that it's firing. Okay? So increased vagal tone means the vagus is sending more neurotransmitter. But the vagus is inhibitory to the heart. So by releasing its neurotransmitters onto the heart muscle, the vagus is telling the heart to slow down its contraction rate. Remember, the heart has a built-in pace that if you severed all the nerves from it, it would beat at a certain frequency. The vagus says slow that down. So it takes it longer between each beat, and that's of course by definition of cardiac output going to decrease cardiac output, which in this case reduces the blood pressure because you're forcing less blood into the aorta. You're going to therefore apply less pressure to the overall systemic circuit. And so that's one way in which the negative feedback works. The bottom line says that the vasomotor center, which is the part of the brain that's in control of vasomotion, right? What is vasomotion? What did I say vasomotion is? No. There's two aspects to vasomotion. Vasomotion refers to changing the diameter of vessels. So vasomotion includes both vasoconstriction and vasodilation, which are opposites of each other. Well, in this case, what would be called for if the blood pressure is too high? What you want to do is vasodilate, notice. Because when you open it up the tube more, that's going to have less, it's going to pressurize the fluid less. Just like if when you take your finger off of the end of the hose, the pressure drops, right? So that's what the vasomotor center responds as. The baroreceptors telling it that the blood pressure is too high means that the vasomotor center, which would usually cause vasoconstriction, the vasomotor center is inhibited, though. So this keeps these neurons from firing. And remember that vasodilation is not active, really. Vasodilation really just means that you're not allowing those smooth muscles to contract. And therefore, since they're just limp, the blood pressure opens up the tube. That's how vasodilation is achieved. When the vasomotor center is inhibited, that means you have reduced sympathetic tone. The output of the sympathetic nervous system is reduced. Those neurons are firing less, and therefore vasodilation occurs. Blood opens up the vessels more, and therefore the pressure drops. Yeah. They are both happening at the same time. I'm just saying it's two parts of the brain that are responding to differently to the same original signal. But notice that this top one, the cardioinhibitory center, that's having an effect on the heart. The vasomotor center is having an effect on the vessels, and they both at the same time can reduce blood pressure back to what it normally should be. So it's classic negative feedback. All right, 15. We've already talked a few times about the fact that you're never sending blood through all of your vessels at once, that you would go into shock if that occurred. So you're shunting blood moment to moment from one place to another, shutting certain parts down, opening up other parts. The majority of your body is shut down at any given moment, but not for very long. That can happen on a per capillary bed basis. And that's what happens really continuously, no matter what you're doing. But there's also, if you go backwards in the circuit from the capillaries to the arteries, which is backwards in terms of flow, that would be going upstream, right? When you cause vasoconstriction upstream, you're going to affect more and more stuff downstream, because the bigger the artery is, the more branches it leads to. And so that's what this picture is trying to indicate. Right after you have eaten a big meal and feel like taking a nap, you feel like taking a nap basically because your body is trying to go into digestion mode rather than exercise mode. And if you allow yourself to relax, like this dude is doing, with his feet up, it's not so important right now to send a lot of blood to the skeletal muscles for exercise. And that's why in this condition, there's reduced flow to the legs because the iliac arteries that branch off of the abdominal aorta and serve the lower limbs get constricted. They undergo vasoconstriction, sending less blood to the legs. Meanwhile, another branch upstream of that of the iliac branch, upstream in the abdominal aorta, that gets vasodilated. This superior mesenteric artery, that is an artery that sends blood to the gut, to the intestines and associated structures. Digestive organs. They get a lot of blood flow to deal with this incoming food while you rest. And then, on the other hand, when you're out playing soccer, then it's more important to send the blood to the skeletal muscles because they require so much oxygen and glucose. Therefore, the opposite happens. The iliac arteries are dilated. Superior mesenteric artery is vasoconstricted because even if you have food to digest, it can wait until after you're done playing soccer. By the way, it also happens with other activities. It doesn't have to be soccer. Okay, 16. Well, these pie charts show you at rest and during exercise on the right. This is showing you what the blood flow is in milliliters per minute to the various parts of the body. And notice that at rest, notice that the difference between at rest and moderate exercise is mainly that the skeletal muscles really require a lot more blood. But look at the total at the top. At rest, you have a total cardiac output of about 5 liters per minute. You're just sitting there. Moderate exercise, more than 3 times that cardiac output. You know that by experience, right? Your heart's beating much faster and more strongly. You can feel it beating in your chest if you're exercising. Sending up more than 3 times the amount of blood in the same time during exercise. So even though a lot of these slices they are getting smaller here because they're a smaller percentage of the overall flow, they actually are getting bigger than their own slice at rest. It's just that the whole pie really represents more than 3 times the flow. What I mean here by example is coronary, the blood flow to the heart itself, 200 milliliters per minute. Well, it increases during exercise, of course, even though the sector here, which is the proper name for a pie slice, looks like about the same size. It's really, you see what I'm saying here?
Yeah.
All right. The digestive system, though, during exercise, that really gets short shrift. That really collapses because it's not needed. Digestion can be put off temporarily until you're not exercising again. Some things can't be, of course. You don't want to shut down blood flow to your brain, for instance, which will kill you. Okay, now to 17. This is illustrating the major ways in which things can move between the blood and the tissue. Now, we've already talked about the fact that transfer of things between blood and tissues occurs mainly at capillaries, right? Doesn't occur at arteries. It occurs mainly at capillaries because there are so many capillaries, and because they're so small, they're ideally suited for that exchange. Where else does exchange take place, though, besides the capillaries? Well, if it's not the arteries, and it is the capillaries, what would be the next? What kind of veins? Venules, right. So there's a lot of exchange that takes place between venules and surrounding tissue as well, similar to that happens in capillaries. It's just that there are so many more capillaries than there are venules that as a percentage of the exchange, capillaries are responsible for by far most of it. Anyway, this shows you the major ways in which things can get out of the blood to the surrounding tissue, although the reverse can occur as well. You have filtration pores that we talked about in fenestrated capillaries, right? And those are really just like holes in a sieve or a mesh. If things that are small enough to get through there, they're going to be forced through. It's not diffusion causing filtration. Filtration is caused by hydrostatic pressure. So the blood pressure itself is squeezing things out of these small holes that make up the filtration pores. Anything that's small enough will be filtered. And this is exactly how urine starts being produced, right? It gets squeezed out of the bloodstream at the kidneys. But that's just one mechanism of getting something out of the bloodstream. We're looking, of course, at the lumen of a capillary here, in case you didn't realize that. But the yellow stuff here, those are endothelial cells making up that lining. You can also have just diffusion through the actual endothelial cell. And this happens well for only certain kinds of particles. What kinds of things are easily able to diffuse through the endothelium? Or, for that matter, through any cell's membrane. Small nonpolar particles, exactly, are well suited for diffusion through the plasma membrane. You have to be small enough just because, I mean, for obvious reasons, but why do you have to be nonpolar also to diffuse directly through the phospholipid bilayer? Because the interior of the thickness where those phospholipid tails are is hydrophobic. So if you're a small, nonpolar, and therefore hydrophobic particle, you can go right through the cell membrane. And so this happens, this is how carbon dioxide and oxygen get exchanged. They are both nonpolar, right? O2, CO2 are both nonpolar, and they're both small. It's not the only things that can diffuse, though anything small and nonpolar can do that. What's going to determine the direction of that? The concentration gradient, exactly. Transcytosis literally means... Well, condition is osis, trans means across, and site is cell. So it's the condition of crossing or going through the cell. In this case, it's an example of what? Based on this picture, what kind of transport is transcytosis? Well, it's more general than that. Exocytosis is an example of what? Vesicular transport. Transcytosis is actually partly endocytosis and partly exocytosis. So on the luminal side of this cell, the side facing the blood, there's endocytosis of some of the contents of the plasma. Those are taken up into a vesicle, which is now inside the endothelial cell. But then at the superficial side of it, the outside of this the capillary, exocytosis will release that vesicular contents into the interstitium surrounding the capillary. So transcytosis works through the cell because on one side it's bringing it in, on the other side it's leaving it out. Yeah. It can happen in reverse as well, yeah. They're just showing you, all of these are showing you for outward direction. And then intercellular clefts we already spoke about, right? Those are little gaps between adjacent endothelial cells. And they kind of act like little flaps. So larger things that would be too large to filter out, like hormones, for instance, larger hormones at least, you know, which can be pretty big proteins, or they're at least polypeptides, those could leave through intercellular clefts. All right, now to 18. On the left side, we have an arteriole. On the right side, a venule. And then joining the two, just for simplicity, is just a single capillary. Of course, it's really going to be a capillary bed like we've already looked at. But just for the simplicity, we're looking at a single capillary. And what we're seeing here is that there is a lot of movement of water into and out of capillaries. And most of the outward flow of water occurs at the arterial end of the capillary, meaning right where at the beginning of the capillary in terms of blood flow. And the movement of water into the capillary occurs at the venous end, right before the capillary ends and it joins to a venule. Here's why. There's competing forces at play here. There is hydrostatic pressure, the pressure of a fluid, which in this case is the blood pressure, when you're talking about inside the capillary. There's a certain blood pressure, which is the hydrostatic pressure. And it's higher at the arterial end than at the venous end, because this very constricted capillary, which is, remember, smaller than the diameter of an erythrocyte, has a lot of friction it's applying to the blood. And therefore, the pressure drops as you go, even though this capillary is only a few millimeters long, the pressure drops measurably from the arterial end to the venous end because of all this friction. So there is a greater tendency for the blood pressure to squeeze water out of the arterial end than there is at the venous end. Okay? Now, there's also hydrostatic pressure in the interstitium, the fluid outside of the capillary, which is just the general background here. But the hydrostatic pressure for the interstitium is actually negative slightly, like it has a slight suction to it. And so on the arterial end, the hydrostatic pressure and the interstitial pressure combine into an overall tendency for water to leave. Okay, now opposing that, the hydrostatic pressure, in other words, that pressure component favors outward flow of water. Opposing that is what we call colloid osmotic pressure. And we've talked a little bit about colloids, right? They're suspensions of particles that aren't really truly dissolved, but they act like solutes as far as osmosis is concerned. And the blood, which of course contains plasma, has a bunch of plasma proteins, which contribute to the colloid osmotic pressure of the blood. The higher the colloid osmotic pressure, the greater the tendency for water to move where those colloids are. Well, there are proteins in both the blood and in the interstitium, but there are many more proteins in the blood than in the interstitium. So there's always a higher colloid osmotic pressure in the blood compared to the interstitium, which means that the sum of those two always is going to favor inward movement of water by osmosis from the interstitium into the bloodstream, into the capillary. Okay? Now, this is happening at both ends. Outward tendency because of hydrostatic pressure and inward tendency because of colloid osmotic pressure. Well, the colloid osmotic pressure doesn't really change at either end, but the hydrostatic pressure changes because of this reduction in blood pressure as you go from the arterial to the venous end. So at the venous end, the colloid osmotic pressure actually wins out. It's greater than the hydrostatic pressure. And therefore, the overall tendency for water is to move inwardly rather than being squeezed outwardly. What this means is that as blood travels through a capillary, it loses a bunch of water at the arterial end, but then reclaims a bunch of that water at the venous end. Okay? Not all of it, though. It reclaims about 85% or so of the water that seeps out. That comes in mainly because of albumin. Albumin, which is the most prevalent plasma protein, like we talked about before, that's the main reason why the colloid osmotic pressure is so high in the blood, and therefore that's the main reason why most of the fluid that's lost gets reclaimed. It's not 100% though, and that is one of the major reasons why you have a lymphatic system. If you didn't have a lymphatic system, even though you're getting back 85% on average, that means you're losing 15% on average. And if you let that happen indefinitely, that fluid is going to remain outside of the bloodstream. It's going to accumulate more and more in the tissue space. And what do we call that condition? Edema, right. And edema can kill you depending on where it's happening. So that's a major function of the lymphatic system, which is where we're going next, right, chapter-wise, is to reclaim the fluid that other 15% that doesn't get back into the blood gets reclaimed by a whole separate system of tubes called lymphatic vessels. Now, the lymphatic vessels, as we'll see, eventually dump this stuff back into the bloodstream, just not at the capillaries from which it was originally lost. All right, they get dumps back into veins near the heart so that the pressure is low there. Okay. 19 is the final slide. And this is something we've already talked about. What's happening here? What's the name for what's happening here? What name did I give this? The pushing of blood through veins via contraction of muscles is called what? It's called the skeletal muscle pump. Right? So remember that veins, which are very low blood pressure, the bigger veins do, not the venules, but the veins have flaps in their interior acting as valves, as you see here. Remember I was talking about gravity winning out if you're standing up? Gravity is trying to pull blood that's downward in the veins of your legs, whereas the flow should be upward to get that blood back to your heart from your legs. Well, there's not enough pressure, just blood pressure in the veins to win out over gravity, so it would pool in the legs. And it does anyway in people with weak valves in their veins. Skeletal muscle pump, though, works because of the fact that when a muscle contracts, of course its volume doesn't change, right? When a muscle contracts, you're not changing the amount of muscle that's there. So it has the same volume. By definition, it's getting shorter, though, if it's contracting. So the only way you can have the same volume if you get short is to get bigger in another dimension. And that's why a skeletal muscle, when it contracts, like you see, it bulges in the center. It gets wider to hold that same volume. And when it bulges in the center, that means it's going to push on veins that are running side by side with that muscle. That pushing from the outside by muscles on veins is the skeletal muscle pump. Notice, though, that if you were to do that, you know, just imagine a tube that you're squeezing the middle of. Yeah, it's going to cause the fluid where you're squeezing with your hand to move away from your hand, but it's going to move away in both directions, right? What causes the unidirectional flow when the skeletal muscle pump operates is the fact that you have valves in these veins. So yeah, it's trying to go in both directions, but going downward will just force the valve closed, which means now the only way it can get out of where it's being squeezed is to go upward toward the heart. And we're done.